All right, good morning, folks. Thank you for having me and folks out in the internet. Today, I'm going to try to give you a bit of background about internet technology, and in particular, technology developments over the last 10 years that will hopefully provide some baseline to inform discussions later in the day. That was my charge. I'm going to break this talk up into five sections. First, I'm going to do a bit of terminology background, because Ruth assured me that there's a varying level of expertise and understanding of the internet, how the internet works. So I'm going to talk a bit about traffic, topology, transit, how packets get from one end to the other of the internet. Then I'm going to use this terminology to describe evolutionary developments in the last 10, 12 years, in particular with respect to the emergence of what we have started to call platforms, the interconnection of these platforms, and the complexity that has emerged because of this development. I'm going to talk about the implications of the changing face of interconnection and the implications in particular for competition issues and consumer harm. Fourth, I'm going to talk about some technology attempts, including one notable one that the FCC took on in the last decade, to try to measure and mitigate these potential harms. And finally, I'll wrap it up with hopefully giving you a summary of really how you should think about what, or how I think about what's different this decade. At a high level, so five parts. An overarching goal here is, as Ruth said, to sort of elucidate, and this is a question from the hearing page, what technological developments, or lack thereof, are important for understanding the competitiveness of the industry or impacts on the public interest. Terminology. So I know that if you get two lawyers in a room, you can get at least two different definitions of what the internet is. It's also true for technologists, however. So for the purposes of this talk, we're going to describe the internet as something that carries traffic routed across a platform that is composed of devices that are reachable with IP addresses. IP stands for Internet Protocol. And indeed, the Internet Protocol is part of a suite of protocols developed as part of a big government project many years ago. And the technologists think about these protocols in what they call an hourglass architecture, an hourglass stack. But the IP protocol is at the center of this stack. It's called the narrow waist of this stack. And the reason it is like that is that all traffic, no matter what application it is or what physical type of medium it's going across that is on the internet, will speak this IP protocol at the network layer. So any content, any eyeballs, the eyeballs are over here on the left, in order to get access to internet content or to request internet content, they're using a public IP address in order to do so. Sometimes in homes or enterprises, you may have a private IP address and you're negotiating your communication with the internet through a public IP address that's proxying these transactions for you. So content, services, routers, they all have these IP addresses. Okay, how do these IP addresses connect? So many IP addresses can be on a router. Routers then compose to form networks. These networks on the global internet are referred to as autonomous systems. That is, all networks owned by a given enterprise. They're called autonomous systems because they interact independently on the global internet. They can decide what their own routing policy is and then announce that routing policy to the rest of the internet, and it propagates across the global internet. There are about 70,000 of these autonomous systems today. It's growing. It's been growing for decades. And they all independently connect. There's no overarching authority. There's no centralized database of where these ASs, of who owns these ASs, where they are. There's different databases around the world that hold information for different ASs. There's no map of these ASs, how these connect, but it's all done independently. So in this world, how does it work? How does it work to get content from one place to the other? So I'm going to introduce a couple of other terms called transit, which is how transportation of packets, because the whole thing is operated by packets instead of the old telephony model of circuit switch networking. So packets are the unit of content that is sent across the network, and traffic flows from the source of content here on the right in the blue network to the person who's requesting the content, say the residential broadband provider, or sometimes they call it an eyeball network on the left side, the red bubble, through what they call transit providers. And a transit provider is somebody who provides transit for packets, for traffic. That is, it's their job to get traffic from one place to another. That's an independent line of business. Now, way back when, in the good old days, in the early 90s, you could imagine this connection of all of these ASs, and there weren't 70,000 back then, but there were several thousand, as a hierarchy, which was a reflection of how money flowed in the ecosystem. So customers, represented at the bottom of this graph, say universities like UCSD or MIT, would pay, will pay, this is still true, will pay a provider called a transit provider for getting traffic to them. And the way this works is that each of these independent networks at the edge, meaning at the bottom of this hierarchy, will announce what IP addresses they have on their network, and they want traffic for those IP addresses to be sent over that link that they're announcing it on. So money flows, there's little dollar signs on the arrow, the money flows up this hierarchy and traffic flows down the hierarchy. Well, traffic flows in both directions, but in general, the way you think about it is you send traffic up, you send money up the hierarchy in order for your addresses to be announced, and the person that you're paying will announce your addresses further up into the, propagate them across the internet. That's called a customer-provider relationship. Still a very canonical relationship on the internet. Another relationship that emerged in the early days of the internet was one where money wasn't transferred. Money wasn't transferred if two networks looked at each other and thought, you look about the same size as me, and we exchange approximately the same size of traffic. So creating a contract to exchange money and try to figure out who should pay who every month or whatever seems like a lot of work, and there wasn't actually technology for doing that. There wasn't accounting built into the internet, as Dave Clark likes to say, money routing protocols. So they just called themselves peers, and they had what they called settlement-free interconnection. Sometimes still true today, less true today. Today you can have some hybrids of these two, like what they call paid peering. We can talk about that, but I'm gonna oversimplify this for the purpose of explaining the highlights of how this works. And then entire industries emerged to facilitate this interconnection between these growing number of ASs. The industry is called Internet Exchange. At one point it was called Internet Exchange Points. And in fact, the decade that the US government got out of the business of providing internet backbone service, back in the mid-90s, they actually did a little bit of lightweight industrial policy to make sure that there were exchange points that some networks had to connect to, some regional networks, these sort of middle guys in this diagram, in order to prevent partitioning from happening when the US government pulled out of the operating a backbone, the NSFNet backbone, back in 94. Okay, now, this can get a little wiggy inside the network. It can get complicated. I'm gonna show one slightly still simplified example of how complicated this can get, because not only is each AS, each autonomous system, independently making decisions about who it should peer, who it should connect with, who it should be a provider or customer and peer with, but each router inside the AS at a protocol level is also making locally optimal decisions about its choice of the next hop along the path. And because of that, you can end up with, and often end up with, asymmetric routes in a perfectly rational world because you're trying to optimize your cost or some performance metric as you're trying to pick what is your next hop across the network. So for example, back to this content and access, let's talk about the content network in the blue and the access network in the red, and you've got three different transit networks in the middle. The red network, let's call it the access network, which has eyeballs, so think of it as a residential broadband network, has two potential upstream, they call it, or transit providers it can choose from. So say it sends a request, you send a request, and your upstream provider decides to send it across this upper path, the two green networks at the top of the diagram, to get to the source of content. And then the network hosting the content happens to, in this case, have one option to the global internet. That's actually the common case. Most of those 70,000 networks only have one link to the rest of the internet. They call it a default route. And so it's gonna send the response through this to its one upstream provider. And then that network, the upper green network, actually has two options to send its content back, the return path. And one of them you'll see has the little red circle with the line through it. It's a peer, meaning it doesn't actually pay to send traffic across that link. So that's the link it's probably going to choose. And that's how you can end up with, one example of how you can end up with asymmetric routing. Very common. And again, multiplied by 70,000 networks and millions of paths. Now, we're into phase two of the talk now, evolution over the last 10 years. What has happened in the last 10 years? And this was happening a little bit before. This is an evolution, not a point change, is that given the relentless growth in demand for mostly video, very high volume content, and the need for providers, both content and access, to optimize performance, reliability, availability, and cost of getting this content to consumers, you see a trend of content moving closer to consumers, as close as it can move. Indeed, any source of content is going to want to remove transit providers from its path, and if possible, even go directly to where the consumers are, if possible, because it's going to reduce its cost. It doesn't have to pay transit fees. It may have to pay interconnection fees to the person that it's directly interconnecting to. And it's going to improve performance for consumers, so all a win. And that has been happening. In addition, what's been happening, economic forces, is a consolidation in these sources of content. Consolidation is normal in an industry. So while there continue to be small local content providers, most traffic is now handled by a few very large content providers. Google handling YouTube, and again, much of it is driven by video traffic, which is very high bandwidth traffic, or independent content providers who provide the service of moving transiting traffic around to third parties like other content providers that don't have their own network, say like CNN, for example. And the job of that content distribution network is to get the traffic from where it enters your network. If you are your own CDN, then it's your network, to where it's going to exit your network, hopefully as near to the consumer as you can get it at the lowest cost that you can do it. Straightforward. Key driver, again, that's really brought these two factors, interconnection and content distribution, to the fore is the internet basically eating the television industry, which we are seeing happen very systematically. And the next industry to be eaten is gaming, so we're watching that happen too. Okay, so there's a few different ways that that the content providers can do this, can distribute content, can get it close to the consumer. As I said earlier, they can try to connect directly to the consumer. That's the bottom scenario here. The blue network is still the content network, and the red network is the access or eyeball network. Think about your home broadband provider. If there is transit in the middle, the green networks, then you can imagine the content still going across these transit networks, but you can also use what's known as caching, keeping a copy of the traffic at an intermediate point in the network, in your network, if you're the content provider and you're directly attached to the transit, but near the edge of your network, or actually in the access network. And so this is an increasingly common mode of distributing content for large companies. But large companies will probably combine all three strategies as needed, flexibly, to make sure that they can get content as effectively and, again, cheaply to consumers. You would think some consolidation would actually reduce the complexity. Turns out not. Although you do have a meme going around about the death of the transit industry, meaning there are fewer transit providers than there were 10 years ago, certainly providers that only do transit as a line of business. There are certainly providers that have a transit line of business, but they also have other lines of business, generally more profitable lines of business, because just moving packets around, doesn't tend to be as profitable as other lines of business that many of the, what we used to think of as transit providers, can get into. But what you do have is a tremendously dense interconnection between these large transit providers and the access providers. It's very hard to measure this. Internet wasn't designed to be measured very well, and the increasing complexity of this interconnection makes it harder to measure. Okay, but there's something even more fundamental about the evolution of interconnection in the last 10 years that is important for thinking about competition and consumers, which is that instead of the dense mesh of interconnection between ISPs that are primarily transit providers, their main job is moving packets around, and they more or less look like the other in terms of a line of business. What you're seeing in the last 10 years is, and again, it's a transition, is providers that don't look like each other. They're not in the same lines of business, or maybe one of them might be in multiple lines of business and another is only in a content line of business, interconnecting. So this is a fundamentally different type of interconnection. And indeed, some of these companies are in multiple layers of this diagram. The way we think about this is, from a technological perspective, is these companies operate at different layers of the internet ecosystem, different technological layers. Now, this is going to sound like, this looks a bit like the diagram I presented earlier about the protocol architecture, and indeed some of these will map to different protocols that are used. The lambdas and the fibers at the lower layer are also operated by lower layer protocols. And the IP layer in the middle there is the IP layer in the hourglass architecture. And the content layers at the top are platforms that are built on top of the IP platform. We can think of Facebook as a platform built on top of the IP platform. You can think of some entire companies built on top of the Facebook platform. So the Facebook itself is a platform. It's sort of a single company platform. The IP platform, very importantly, is a multi-company, multi-industry, open platform, which is the reason that you had so much vibrancy and investment and competition and lots of creative innovation happening at the IP layer, because it was completely open. You did not have to license anything from anybody to connect to the internet. As long as you had IP addresses and you knew somebody else with IP addresses, you could be on the internet. Now, since I've now talked about platforms a little bit, I'm going to acknowledge that there are two different definitions of platform that seem to be dueling. And I hear economists use one definition, and I hear technologists use another definition, and now they've started to use both definitions, and it's not always clear to me if they know which definition they're using. And since many of the companies operating in the internet ecosystem now and interconnecting are both kinds of platforms, I want to make sure we inject some clarity here. So the two kinds of platforms, and there's an OECD report coming out that describes this a lot better than I do and gives lots more depth, are, again, what I think of as the economic definition. An online marketplace, the first definition, that places one type of consumer, in touch with another type of customer. So we all know this as a multi-sided market or two-sided market. Often in the internet, a platform will be a multi-sided market. Airbnb, Amazon Marketplace, buyers and sellers, Craigslist, eBay. These are economic platforms from an economic perspective, multi-sided platforms. And that's important because when you think about interconnection across platforms that may involve different markets, you have to think about the incentives of those different markets. The other kind of definitional platform that technologists have been using for a long time is a group of technologies on which you build another group of technologies. And so the emphasis in this definition is programmability. There's a service component. It's general. You can build entire services on top of underlying platforms. So examples are IP itself, as I mentioned earlier. Operating systems are platforms. Amazon Web Services is now a platform, and I'll talk about that in a couple slides. Oh, in this slide. The fastest growing part of the internet ecosystem right now is what we call cloud service platforms. So these were, in some cases, internal platforms to a company. So like think Facebook, but in the case of Amazon, AWS, a set of services that Amazon used internally to build its own lines of business. But it decided that it was going to externalize that and make it available as a new layer through which to distribute content and services and allow other people to use that to build companies. Indeed, many web applications and services and entire companies are now first built upon these giant cloud service platforms. So Amazon, Microsoft, Google even has one now. So, for example, Netflix is built on, all the recommendation system, all the database that's operating Netflix is built on Amazon Web Services. Despite that, Amazon Prime is also the biggest competitor to Netflix at the video layer, at the content layer, right? So this is super interesting. Okay, so what you have happening now, and this was not as true 10 to 15 years ago, is interconnection across platform layers, where companies that used to be what we think of as transit or access providers are also engaged in that content layer, right, in the higher layer. Cloud is also now could be considered a higher layer of the platform stack. Okay, so in 2007, and as was described in the report from 2007, a lot of the regulatory attention was about the access links to the broadband ISP. They mentioned interconnection. FCC, even in the 2015 order, mentioned interconnection as an area that they thought they had jurisdiction over, but they weren't going to do anything about interconnection, including because they recognized they really didn't understand the interconnection ecosystem very well. Nowadays, that is a much bigger focus. And indeed, from a consumer protection and competition perspective, the implications, and so now I'm in part three of the talk, implications, of the interconnection dynamics for competition are that, probably the most notable one, is that smaller players have less opportunity to connect with these large content providers. In fact, submitted to the public comment for these hearings, American Cable Association's report talked about that 85, and that's smaller ISPs represented by that organization, most of these access content providers connect to the big content guys through exchange points. They don't have direct connectivity. And indeed, the smaller content providers are also, by nature of economics and where they are, less likely to vertically integrate themselves. So they cannot leverage the savings you often get from bundling different services to the same customer. And that's particularly hard in the regions where these providers are building out, because it can be much more expensive to build out in those regions. So this puts them at sort of a double disadvantage, let's say. So just to recap, carrier services that are operating on top of this single firm IP platform, so every company that offers internet access, and some companies that don't, operate an IP platform internally, and they compete with third-party services that are running over the common internet platform. And these interconnection points can enable the exercise of market power against these competitors, due to technological opportunities for discriminating against traffic crossing that link, selective dropping, rate limiting, not upgrading capacity of the interconnection links, which could impair QoE, or, and I will acknowledge, perhaps more likely, non-technical ways of doing discrimination, including pricing or business terms that are all generally under NDA. These are not new concerns. In fact, this is a quote from the 2007 report, which really captured these concerns quite beautifully. They've also been captured for many, many years, because they're really fundamentally they're really common carriage concerns. They're really, how do you prevent blocking degradation, discrimination against consumers? In this case, discrimination against content and apps. So a lot of this is about how do you capture the good things that you had about common carriage without all of the baggage that it brings. Okay, section 4 of the talk. Technology that has been tried to address some of these fundamental issues. When AT&T merged with DirecTV it was a long process, but I think 2015 is a good year to pick. There was a lot of consternation in the public comment period by organizations who were concerned about this exact issue, that interconnection would be used as a locus of discrimination by AT&T against its interconnecting parties, both transit and content providers that it directly interconnected with at the time, in favor of DirecTV and against, say, over-the-top content like Netflix or YouTube. And so the FCC, in response to these concerns, attached conditions to the merger. These weren't the only conditions, but this was pretty amazing. It was internet measurement conditions, the first time ever, attached to a merger. And what they said was AT&T was going to be required to measure the interconnection points, only the interconnection points, and that becomes important. The interconnection points with its larger interconnecting parties, and it would bring some source of independent measurement expert to help refine the methodology. But the high level was actually, the requirements for what was going to be measured was actually outlined pretty narrowly in the merger conditions. It was, you had to measure loss, latency, and utilization across these interconnecting points. And the FCC also recognized that for certain kinds of measurements, you were going to get much more fidelity if you actually had cooperation of the interconnecting party. Although, honestly, there's not a lot of technology developed to measure across an interconnecting party between two competing providers. Because as you can imagine, there hasn't been a lot of demand for that kind of technology. So we were actually the independent, CADA and MIT, Dave's in the room, were the independent measurement expert selected for this project. And along the way, we realized that the approach actually begged many questions, including whether measuring individual links, the way that it was outlined in the merger condition, was the right approach to capture important dynamics, and how you would measure the characteristics of those links, because it's tricky. It's especially tricky to do if you do not have cooperation of the other interconnecting party. More importantly, it's not at all clear whether the measurements map to consumer harm. Many of the edge providers, content providers, have gotten quite good at adaptive coding, adaptive bit rates, in order to adapt to perceived congestion or low bandwidth paths from the source of content to the consumer. And I should note, there is no agreed methods to measure the QoE, quality of experience for the user of video. Okay, so this is another quote from the 2007 report. These are really complex empirical questions. These were complex empirical questions in 2007. They're more complex now. In 2007, the FTC report, again, talked about the balance between the competing incentives. Nick is going to talk about the incentives more in a few minutes. On the part of broadband providers, and the focus was on broadband providers back then, to engage in, and the concern is about potential benefits and harms from discrimination and differentiation. And there are potential benefits, and that's what makes this complex, one of the things that makes this complex. So there's a complex empirical question. The FTC's last set of hearings acknowledge the need for further evidence of particular conduct in this area in order to assess harm. This is the open question. How does one gather evidence of particular conduct? So it is not clear to us or anyone what the FCC actually learned from the AT&T reporting exercise. The reporting that occurred went from AT&T to the FCC under protective order. So researchers were not allowed to study any of this. We did not see any of the data that after we approved of the methodology that was used. There are several other approaches to interconnection measurement as well. Some technologists are undertaking some approaches. Some of the video providers themselves, Google had at one point a Google Video Quality Report. Netflix has its own, you know, end-to-end measurements. All of these measure little pieces of the picture with different ways. All of the methodologies have limitations. Really, if you were going to try to integrate and cross-validate, you would need some source of objective perspective. There's no silver measurement bullet for understanding these kinds of issues right now, and there's a limited ability for academics to sustain this kind of work. Take it from me, it's a lot of money to sustain this kind of infrastructure that can do these kinds of measurements, hardware, software, distributing it at places you need. And indeed, I'm just doing a little acknowledgement that after nearly a decade of providing Netalyzer, which is a tool that the FCC did use to try to increase its understanding of paths, because it was sort of a network path analyzer, they took it down for lack of resources to support this open platform for use. And yet, much of this is still research. So what is the FCC measuring? Because many folks talk about the Measure Broadband America system as something that could help in this space. So the Measure Broadband America platform was put in place 8 years ago, maybe, it was last decade, in order to help measure access bandwidth, just the link between the consumer and the broadband access ISP. Why? Because there were consumer complaints, the FTC might have even gotten some of these last decade, that say, oh, my broadband access provider is telling me that I'm getting 50 meg, and I don't think I'm getting 50 meg, and when I use some speed test out there in the world, it says I'm not getting 50 meg. So there's a consumer protection issue, and somebody should do something. And so the FCC launched a program to measure access bandwidth. And they did. And I think that did a reasonable job. It actually solved a problem. It solved one problem. But the FCC is also clear about the limitations of this platform. It does not measure anything about interconnection. It does not capture many things consumers care about, including performance to, say, the top 10 websites. It doesn't talk about data caps. It doesn't talk about the privacy of the connection. It doesn't measure mobile. Actually, there's a separate program to try to measure mobile. Data was just released last month. There's no analysis of the data. There's no report. And Microsoft also recently came out with some data that shed some doubt on the strength of the sampling that's happening in the FCC side, because I think probably the FCC is not sampling rural areas as well as urban areas, because the way that it deployed the little nodes, about 10,000 nodes around the country, is sort of opt-in. You volunteer to take a node. And so those are expected sampling issues. Okay, so in summary, and what to take away from this. Since 2007, the same concerns have expanded to multiple platform layers, to crossing platform layers, and gathering and analyzing evidence has become more difficult, validation has become harder, the complexity of the sector, which was already quite complex, is increasing at the same time that we're putting more of society onto this infrastructure. More is at stake, more is at risk. Why is it so complex? Because these co-evolving adaptive systems integrate forces that are market forces, technology, legal, political, cultural, social. It is hard to keep up. So all the topology and traffic shifts I described to you are not driven by technology, But if we they're driven by economics mostly. But if we do not understand the role, capabilities, and limitations of technology to create and solve problems, attempted interventions are likely to fail. So, last slide. Evidence-based policy needs to understand in the internet ecosystem that the internet operates as a set of layered, multi-sided, sometimes more than two sides, platforms interconnecting across layers, such as from content to transit. But that's only one example. This happens in the mobile space, this happens in the advertising ecosystem, this happens with the cloud, which means you need to understand deeply the platform structure and the dynamics, including the different sides of the markets and their incentives. This is a challenge in achieving relevant transparency and public accountability in operating these platforms that have become critical infrastructure to most aspects of society and how they relate to specific potential harms. And it's been very tricky, as someone who's been in this space for a couple of decades now, to find and fund sources of objective, unbiased expertise. Thank you.